from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at the impact of more cuts from the federal government, this time to Public Allies, which helps develop young leaders. Then we'll explore a documentary about young international students who work in the Wisconsin Dells.
Hearing a lot of long hours at work, the wages are not high, and you know, the students are on this exchange and they're learning a lot, but they're also a big source of labor for Wisconsin Dells.
Plus, we'll learn about the Black Point Estate, a historic home and museum in Lake Geneva.
So we have the house, the gardens, adjacent to the property, a bit of shoreline. So you still get the experience of what it was like to come here and do a little bit of time travel.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Last week, the Trump administration announced the end of a grant supporting hundreds of AmeriCorps programs nationwide. In the Milwaukee area, this includes programs that support affordable home construction, educational support in schools, and deliverable health care services. Public Allies Wisconsin is one of the programs affected. The three-decade-old organization supports local nonprofits, and its alumni include Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, State Representative Darren Madison, entrepreneur Tonda Thompson, and artists Brema Brema and Rosie Petrie. Lake Effect Sam Woods is also an alum of Public Allies Wisconsin. He takes us through the under-the-radar impact of this organization on Milwaukee's culture.
Stop me if you've heard this storyline before. An aimless youth is looking to define the next chapter in their life. They have big ideas for what the world should be, and they know what they're passionate about, but they're having trouble bridging that gap between pursuing their passions and making an impact on the world around them. Today, Brema Brema is the founder and creative director of Unfinished Legacy, a clothing brand that has taken Milwaukee street fashion nationwide and secured partnerships with organizations ranging from the Milwaukee Brewers to the Muhammad Ali Estate. But about 10 years ago, Brema fit this archetype of an aimless youth, undeniably talented, but perhaps directionless.
College wasn't really for me, so when I dropped out, I felt like a failure, and there's a deep self-reflection on why I'm even in America in the first place. You know, my parents moved here from East Africa so that I could have the opportunity to go to school, get an education, and have a career for myself. But things didn't pan out that way. And I think from that sense of feeling like a failure and wanting to be involved with something that was impactful and purposeful for me, and that's how I came across Public Allies.
The Public Allies Brema refers to is the name of an AmeriCorps program active in cities nationwide, but its Milwaukee contingent is particularly strong, with alumni including Milwaukee area politicians, entrepreneurs, activists, and artists. Public Allies is a program within AmeriCorps, a national service organization that pays stipends for volunteer work. Service in AmeriCorps programs are typically finite terms, often less than a year, and they tend to attract young people in their late teens and 20s who are drawn to public service. Public Allies specifically has chapters in cities across the nation. Milwaukee has one of the most prolific chapters, recently celebrating its 30th anniversary and claiming over 900 alumni, about one-tenth of the alumni nationwide. People currently in the program are colloquially referred to as simply Allies. Its hallmark piece is its apprenticeship program, a 10-month experience where allies work full-time in partnership with local nonprofits. Marissa Zane is a clinic supervisor at the Milwaukee Justice Center, and she describes how the two public allies assigned to her organization support its mission.
So we've had a long-standing relationship with Public Allies, supporting the different services we offer, including the mobile legal clinic, which does brief civil and family legal advice outreach clinics in the community. Our allies also support our pardon clinic, which prepares pardon applications for folks trying to get a governor's pardon. And one of our allies also works with the eviction diversion program, which is a court-based program trying to provide solutions for landlords and tenants to avoid eviction or get eviction records sealed.
When Zane describes the work Public Allies at the Justice Center support, this isn't in the form of running errands while other employees do the actual work. The allies are trusted to design systems, such as streamlining the bureaucracy of applying for a governor's pardon for previous convictions.
One of the allies that we have had on board has been working to streamline the process of clients picking up their certified copies. So just a little bit of background. If someone is applying for a governor's pardon, they need certified copies of their court records to submit with their application. And those can be challenging to get, and they also cost money, which is not a resource that is available to everyone. So we have obtained a source of funding to be able to assist folks in getting their certified copies if they wouldn't be able to do so themselves, and having a process to make sure that that's not a stumbling block for folks applying for a pardon. So one of the things our allies has done is made that process easier for the director for the pardon clinic and for the clients who are trying to get the pardon.
People in the Public Allies program serve in a myriad of places. While someone interested in a legal career might be placed at the Milwaukee Justice Center, artists like Brema Brema are matched with organizations that align with their unique skills and passions.
So I joined for both 2 years. And for both 2 years, I was able to be involved with what I was passionate about. The first year, working at True School, was an art instructor with a lot of the youth, just teaching them ways to screen print or use art within their own like projects. And then the second year I worked at MPS as a district photographer. So still just allowing me to pursue my passion and leave an impact with what I was passionate about.
At the same time Brema was serving with Public Allies, Gene Tate was also in the program and doing work with True School, a youth education organization built around engagement and empowerment of youth via arts and hip hop culture. Today, Gene is the event coordinator and community specialist at Unfinished Legacy, but about a decade ago, Gene, like Brema, was clearly talented, but needed direction for how to turn that talent into a lasting positive communal impact.
So when I was introduced, well, in high school, I was just creative. I didn't have the impact on the community part down. My impact on the community was like spray painting on walls.
Just doodling, right?
Yeah, just expressing myself. Sure. I'll say that. My impact was just expressing myself and however that affected the community I wasn't really aware of. I was kicked out of high school. And luckily, MPS allowed me to come back. And that's when a shift in my life happened, where I knew that I needed to figure out what this expression or how this expression was impacting people and being intentional about the energy that I'm putting out into the world.
Shortly after serving with Public Allies, the two threw themselves full-time into Unfinished Legacy and would make their mark on Milwaukee culture.
The chant Bucks and Six is now a clothing brand. The Bucks debuted the new lifestyle apparel brand at Pfizer Forum this past Friday. It's already sold out. This is the first collaboration with Unfinished Legacy, a Milwaukee-born streetwear brand created by Brema Brema, who joins us.
Founded in 2013, Unfinished Legacy began to take off in 2020 when Brema and Gene began making clothing that reflected the summer's political moment in a way that also benefited True School, their previous placement, while they were at Public Allies.
The initial moment when we saw traction with the brand was when we decided to participate in the Black Lives Matter movement. And naturally, like coming from the nonprofit world and trying to use our art as a way to like impact, we created a design that resonated with a lot of people. We ended up raising some funds for True School through that project. And that was the time where we're like, okay, like this could actually become a thing.
And even today, Brema sees Public Allies reflected in the everyday experience of running his business.
The Friday trainings where we had to like go to all these different places in Milwaukee and get to like see all these different cultures, now we see that existing within our own store where like people from all over Milwaukee come in this space and they feel welcome, they feel included.
The Friday trainings Brema mentions are another core piece of the apprenticeship program. In a typical week, allies work Monday through Thursday with their placement organizations, such as the Milwaukee Justice Center, True School, or MPS. But on Fridays, allies gather at a different location in the Milwaukee area each week for professional and personal development, often involving a facilitator from the community with expertise on the day's topic. Nanice Rodriguez is the current executive director of Public Allies Wisconsin, which includes the program in Milwaukee. She describes the kind of professional development skills the allies work on Fridays.
Business casual attire, how to write an email, learning how to write a memorandum of understanding, right? How to facilitate group meetings. Very tangible skills that I think people really, really need that are facilitated in group with the entire cohort, often within smaller groups where folks are really grappling with what it means to sit and work with other people who are very different from me.
The personal development trainings build on that last point. In addition to the more tangible skills of business communication and attire, the Friday trainings often discuss topics ranging from knowing when to speak up versus when to give space for someone else to speak up, to analyzing how isms, racism, sexism, ableism, etc., shape the world we live in, how we perceive the world, and how we see ourselves.
During these trainings, we're really challenged to look at ourselves as whole human beings in professional settings, but also in our personal settings, and looking at the ways in which we might be unintentionally inflicting harm through racist or classist or sexist sort of beliefs that we may not have ever had language for.
Rodriguez says the end result is a lot of tough love, where allies practice keeping each other accountable to maintaining an environment of continuous learning and create space for a cohort of aimless youth to become the best versions of themselves.
We tell folks to trust the process, but we also tell folks that, like, you can do hard things. And these are all really hard things. And when you equip people with that, like that amount of confidence that they may not ever have had, a certain amount of belief in them that they may not ever have had, I think there is like a blooming of a person. And so I think that's part of the magic of like Friday trainings that is kind of hard to explain.
And Marissa Zane of the Milwaukee Justice Center will tell you that this magic doesn't stay put on Fridays. Part of why she hosts allies at the center is because of their training, their perspective, and the language they learn to analyze their lived experience keeps the center accountable to people who are often coming to the center in part because they have been marginalized by the same isms that the allies are discussing on Fridays.
The allies are a really interesting hybrid of the expertise and the specialized knowledge that the clinic supervisors bring. Because they have some of that knowledge and expertise that they gain on the job at the Justice Center. But then they also have their regular people. They are somebody who could be navigating an eviction question, a child support issue. So we get a really great perspective that helps us connect with the clients that we work with. They have some of that expertise, but they also are a little bit removed from it in the way that those of us who have been doing the work, who have the background and have been doing it for years and years, are a little disconnected from. And that perspective is really valuable to bring to connections with our clients.
And even after completing the program, Brema says the lessons from Friday trainings are woven into the fabric of Unfinished Legacy. They are as much a part of the brand as its signature butterfly design.
And we're not a business that likes to talk about like diversity and inclusion because that we live it, you know? And I think a lot of people try to like have those stickers on their walls and stuff like that. But for us, like we really live it. Like all the things that we've learned is like part of like our like bloodstreams now. And like, it's just natural for it to be part of like what we're doing in the world right now.
Those stickers are cool though.
Shout out to those stickers.
The Trump administration and DOGE are trimming more government programs and workforce. The latest has to do with AmeriCorps. You might be thinking, why is that important to me? Well, the cuts will eliminate...
Milwaukee's Public Allies program may be coming to an end soon. After substantial cuts to AmeriCorps recommended by the so-called Department of Government Efficiency have eliminated the grant it relies on. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers announced last week that Wisconsin will be suing to stop the cuts, but for now, the work of public allies in Milwaukee has ceased. For the Milwaukee Justice Center, that means a less efficient justice system. Marissa Zane describes the impact of losing their public ally and the end of the project the ally was designing to streamline the pardon appeal process.
That process of creating that electronic tool was going to make sure that our clinics were using the resources that we have in a way that can be effective and help people who we can really help. We wanted to empower people to understand their legal situation, but also to make sure that we were using our capacity the best that we could by making sure that the folks we were bringing in were folks that we could help move forward in the pardon application process. And unfortunately, that work has been halted.
As for Public Ally's future, Nanice Rodriguez outlines short and long-term goals. In the short term, it's taking care of the young people in this year's cohort who were blindsided by the sudden loss of a paycheck.
First and foremost, ensuring that our current allies are taken care of in some way, figuring out what is our next steps with them in terms of being able to complete their term of service and getting them all of the resources that they need at a really difficult time.
In the long term, Rodriguez is focused on finding ways to continue in uncertain times and reckoning with the loss this is for the organization and for our city.
I wish that I had like a super tangible answer. And I have been wishing this, and I'm going to try not to get emotional, Sam, but I think one of the hardest parts of this week has been telling my allies that I don't know, that we don't know. And so I think technically speaking, I am not sure. What I do know to be true is that Public Allies is such a force. Like, it is a home to so many that it feels impossible for us to have a Milwaukee without Public Allies.
That piece was produced by Lake Effect Sam Woods. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about Black Point Estate, an historic home and museum in Lake Geneva. But first, we'll look at a documentary about the Wisconsin Dells and the international students who provide much of the labor for that tourist attraction. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Wisconsin Dells is a city full of kitschy tourist attractions that draw big crowds, especially in the summer months. A new documentary called The Dells captures the escapism the Dells can offer, but also the reality of life for international students who work at the resorts. Students from countries like Turkey, Romania, and the Dominican Republic work in low-paying jobs as servers, housekeepers, and lifeguards. WUWM's Mayan Silver is joined by the Dells' filmmaker Nellie Clues.
How did you focus on this fairly touristy, small Wisconsin town? What was the allure there? Like, do you have a personal connection?
Well, when I started making the movie, I was based in Iowa City, and I had lived in Chicago immediately prior to that. So I'm really interested in tourism as a topic. I like tourist places because I think they're these places that are set up for a feeling of escape, a feeling of kind of transcendence. And to me, it's kind of always fascinating to see what goes on behind the scenes to make that possible. So it felt like Wisconsin Dells was reminiscent of places I had been, you know, in my childhood and later for vacations or just passing through without knowing the town specifically before I went there. But yeah, it felt it had that familiarity because, you know, there's a certain a certain consistency of places that are set up for this kind of tourist spectacle. And I was immediately really fascinated by the place when I went and wanted to spend more time filming.
And of course, you were following the students, and, you know, it's the students play a big role in the film. They're on J-1 student visas. They come from all over the world. But specifically, Wisconsin Dells was also a character in the film.
Totally.
How did that generate possibilities for you, like being in that kitschy, touristy, vacation-y, escapism environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's set up to kind of dazzle you, and a lot of the time it's effective. There's always something really curious to look at, all this novelty architecture that I found really fascinating, and a lot of layers to the space and the place that you can kind of see having built up over time. And, you know, there's something, even though I found plenty of things that don't appeal to me about the place in a way, I also find that, like, with new people coming all the time to enjoy themselves, there is this constantly renewing stream of activity and stream of people, and it does kind of keep things interesting and keep things fresh. Including the students who I filmed with, new people would come every year, and they're experiencing it in this very novel way. So I was kind of going along with that perspective as much as I could.
One of my favorite scenes was when a bunch of students were at a cookout, and one of the girls was talking about how much she's working and being underpaid, very matter-of-factly. And she says she doesn't really love the U.S. because the food is bad. And earlier you had shown this, like, close-up shot of a really processed-looking hot dog sitting there glistening on a grill, or a bunch of hot dogs. I guess what I wanted to ask about that is the film doesn't try to beat you over the head with a perspective on capitalism or low-wage jobs. How do you intentionally keep your, or do you intentionally keep your storytelling that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine line. What I really love about the observational style of filmmaking, and why I keep coming back to it, is that obviously I'm bringing a perspective as a person, as a filmmaker. I'm not purposefully withholding, you know, judgment on what I see. But I do think that for me, whenever you spend time in a specific place with a specific set of people, there's just such a multiplicity of experiences, people's opinions that you hear, you know, versions of a place that I do try to keep a certain openness to a finished film, because people are bringing a lot to the place. People are bringing their own expectations to the film. And what I really want is for people to be able to have an open-minded experience of a place that is, of course, shaped and people that they're sort of meeting in the movie. Of course, it's shaped by me and my interests and sensibility and what I, you know, observe as the reality of what's happening. But I think that for me, when the openness of the perspective feels just most honest, and it allows for lots of different kinds of people, hopefully, to enter into the film and see what they can find and experience there.
Totally. Like, there was a Pied Piper scene. I guess there's some sort of exhibit at Wisconsin Dells with the Pied Piper, and it's very, like, how would you even describe
it? It's a mechanical clock. It's kind of a Glockenspiel, I guess, a version of it. Anyone who's been downtown in the Dells has probably seen this. It strikes on the hour throughout the day, and it tells this recorded story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. And there's, like, little mechanical figures that go around, like the rats and the kids and the Pied Piper.
And the story is that the Pied Piper, you know, was sent, am I getting this right? The Pied Piper was hired by the town to get rid of the rats and charm the rats away, but then didn't get due payment from the town.
That's the fable.
And so were you, I guess that was one of the times in the film where I was like, is there symbolism here about the students that are working in this town and maybe not getting their just wages? I know I probably shouldn't ask you directly.
No. I mean, I think obviously that I'm having fun in the film and, you know, expressing my point of view with the editing and the aesthetic choices that I'm making. And I do think when I saw that clock, I both find it really fascinating and kind of funny as an object. And also it kind of felt like, you know, a nod to all of the conversations that I was hearing among all the students who, you know, a lot of them, I can't speak for everyone, of course, and I'm not one of the students myself, but, you know, hearing a lot of long hours at work, the wages are not high. And, you know, the students are on this exchange and they're learning a lot, but they're also a big source of labor for Wisconsin Dells and other resort towns like that. And, you know, there's a certain there was a certain resonance there that I felt I really wanted to include and, you know, just put in. Plus, you get to see all the cool little rats going around, and it's like fun to see.
And speaking of the different types of students that you spoke with from all over the world, are you aware of how the current political climate is affecting students in the Dells now that student visas are being revoked in the U.S. fairly arbitrarily?
Yeah, I mean, that's that dynamic, you know, across the country has given me a different perspective on the film and all the students I met. I'm not aware of specific changes to this particular program because I think a lot of the visas that have been revoked are more students who are at universities in the U.S. So I'm not aware, but that doesn't mean it hasn't been happening. And, you know, I think a lot of students, you know, if they're paying attention, would think twice about coming. You know, maybe they're not feeling like it would be as safe of a place. But, you know, I think, you know, people are coming, and I don't think there's been specific changes. But I do think that the tone feels really different. And I think students I've talked to who I keep in touch with would find it to be very different now, and just in terms of the welcome that they're receiving.
But you didn't see much political organizing or speaking out necessarily among students at the Dells.
No, again, I just met some students, and there's so many more that I could never meet. And everyone has their own, you know, their own beliefs and perspectives. But I do think that, like, in terms of from a sort of labor perspective, one of the reasons that it's beneficial for U.S. employers to have these visitors is because, you know, they kind of come and go. It's a cycle. People will come back again for multiple years. But, you know, they have to kind of always, there's always a new crop of people figuring out afresh what is going on, what the rules are. So I do think it is a source of labor that is kind of convenient for employers because they're new. You know, you need time and consistency to kind of organize. And I do think that's one aspect that I found interesting of this structure of work program.
So after spending, you know, that much time in the Dells, what ultimately were your takeaways? Like, did it surprise you in any way?
I was surprised because I think I set out to make a movie that felt like a really fun sort of teen or young adult summer film. And I think there was aspects of that to the movie. People are meeting new friends, they're partying, they're getting to know this strange new place. But I think that there was a lot more long work hours and just sort of banal trips.
Adulting.
Trips to Walmart, having to deal with housing, having to pay for housing. I think probably the film was specifically colored by also filming during 2020 and 2021. So that was a big disruption because of COVID. Obviously, even though students still came, it was certainly not the most fun time to come. And yeah, just sort of getting to know the ins and outs of this program and the people doing it. My main takeaways are just being really impressed and admiring of the people who come. You know, it's a kind of a really brave thing to do, to come without your family. You know, maybe you're not fluent in English, and it's a real leap of faith. And some people have a great experience. Others, I feel, are a bit let down by their experience in the U.S. because they really get to see, you know, what it's like to just be sort of a working class person here who, you know, no matter your status or your background at home, you're working a service industry job, you're not making a lot of money, and there's a lot of hassle and stress with that. So I think, yeah, again, I can never generalize for everyone, but it was a little bit more stressful and tiring for them than I might have guessed before I got to meet people.
Nellie Kluse, thank you so much for talking to us about your new documentary, The Dells.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Nellie Kluse is the director of the documentary, The Dells. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. The documentary is showing today at the Downer Theater as part of the Milwaukee Film Festival. Milwaukee Film is a financial contributor to WUWM. It's time now for our Tavern Tuesday series. We're partnering with the Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin to bring you stories about beer and brewing in our state. We're sharing these histories ahead of the grand opening of the restored Witten... To bring you stories about beer and brewing in our state. We're sharing these histories ahead of the grand opening of the restored Witten Abel's Tavern at Old World Wisconsin. Today we'll hear from Dave DeSimone. He's the director of Black Point Estate, an historic home and museum in Lake Geneva. The 1888 Queen Anne-style home belonged to Conrad Seip, an influential brewer during the Gilded Age. WUWM's Eddie Morales joins DeSimone at the estate to explore its history and artifacts.
Imagine it's 1888, and this is a 8,000-square-foot cottage. You know, it's technically a three-seasons house, and we don't have... Well, there's a furnace now, but they never intended to be here all year long. To put things in comparison, this is 8,000 square feet. The average American home at that point was about 1,100 square feet and would often include multi-generational. So maybe grandma and grandpa live with their kids and their grandkids. So this is a second home. This just sort of really speaks to the Gilded Age. We're sort of living in another Gilded Age, if you will, where we have, like we talk now about the 1%. Well, in the 1880s, it's Vanderbilt, Rockefeller, Carnegie, DuPont, you know, the names that we still have, Chase, Morgan, you know, these are still names that are, every household kind of knows them. The Seips aren't in that level, but they're close. And the same thing with Pabst, they all have these vacation homes. So 8,000 square foot home, it's going to have what you would expect for entertaining. First floor, living room, music room, billiard room, and dining room. Second floor, six bedrooms, and then the third floor, seven bedrooms. So in a lot of ways, imagine a big B&B or a historic hotel for your own family. The house, when it was donated to the state of Wisconsin in 2005, so it was Seip, Schmidt, Peterson, it's all the same family. It just gets passed down through the female side. Fourth generation donates it. Everything that you're seeing here, the furniture, the artwork, the rugs, was left here in 2005, and it's sort of mind-boggling to think about what your house looked like, what my house looked like. Most of us didn't have 125-year-old beds that we were still using. They never updated anything here. They just kept it frozen in time, and there were some personal touches. We have a bedroom that would have had a 1970s green shag rug. Most of the books in the bookcases are from the 1880s through the 1920s, but every so often you'll find a DVD tucked in somewhere. It's just little hints of, you know, over multiple generations. You forget something, it gets put away, and then it's just here forever. And that's sort of the story, a historic house that also is layered over time. So, yeah, but we'll head on up to the tower. We're going to go into the tower from a spiral staircase.
DeSimone leads us to the estate's biggest feature, a tower with an impressive view of the lake. He uses a skeleton key to unlock the door.
And then we'll go up the spiral staircase. And then the view over the lake is really pretty remarkable.
Wow.
So the house property sits about 120 feet already above the lake because we're built on a pretty steep bluff. Why we have this tower opposed to like a more balanced traditional style turret. The architect who built this house, his name's Adolf Kudell. He also had just designed a house for the Seips in Chicago in 1887. And we have some correspondence between the two. I'll paraphrase. It's basically Seip talking to his architect saying, I love my house in Chicago, but I don't have a view of Lake Michigan. So whatever you do, make sure I'm always going to have a view of Geneva Lake at my lake house. So it's a little bit of conjecture on my behalf, but I think the architect hears that and then decides we're really going to push that tower above. I mean, we're above the roof line. So This was always a woodlot, but even as these trees have matured in front of the house, you don't have a view of the lake from the first floor. You don't have a view of the lake from the second floor. You sort of have a view of the lake from some of the third floor bedrooms, but these trees are not getting any taller. You always have a view of the lake from where we're at. So we have the house, the gardens adjacent to the property, a bit of shoreline. So you still get the experience of what it was like to come here and do a little bit of time travel. All of our guests arrive through the Lake Geneva Cruise Line. So that's how many of these homes would have had their initial owners arrive. There were roads around the lake, but they were sort of like cart paths. So imagine at one point, there are 60 piers on this lake around 1900. Last year, there were over 1,100. It's the busiest lake in Wisconsin in terms of boat traffic. I couldn't tell you how many boats are on this, but on a typical weekend, if you're a water skier or a kayaker, you'd probably want to be done by about noon. Otherwise, there's going to be a lot of boat wake. So it's pretty spectacular view up here, though.
Just before we came up here, you mentioned something like a newer experience this time around. Mm-hmm. And there's also a new experience called Victorian Living. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So the Institute for Victorian Living is a series that we're running. We're starting it this year. There's a lot of popularity, really beginning with the TV show Downton Abbey and then Bridgerton, where the interest in the Victorian era or the Gilded Age has become popular again in sort of American pop culture. So the Institute for Victorian Living is focusing on etiquette. One of the programs is going to focus on like etiquette and rules of engagement. Another is going to focus on flower arranging and the language of flowers. Like everything's very symbolic in the Victorian era. So in some of those traditions that we still follow today, like if you have a romantic interest, you're probably not going to give her carnations. You're going to give her roses. You know, carnations are what you might give your mom for Mother's Day. So a lot of those traditions come out of the Victorian era. And then the third installment in this year's series is going to focus on the Victorian weddings that took place not only at Black Point, but at a number of the lake estates that have been around. And we'll have Victorian wedding dresses on display. So it's an opportunity for patrons to come. We encourage people to come in Victorian garb or Victorian hat. There will be a tea service served on the veranda. It will be more immersive than coming for a tour. A tour is wonderful, but it's very much we're presenting information and you're digesting it. The Victorian Living Program will allow you to enjoy this estate as maybe you would have been a guest 120 years ago. So I want to head back down? Or?
Sure, yeah.
So it's just always awkward to get back in the staircase. It's like getting into the hull of a boat. I say whatever works for you. Some people sit down. You're a little bit taller. But whatever is comfortable. Just don't hold on to this because it'll close.
Okay. So. I take Dee Simone's advice as I head downstairs. The stained glass windows to my left help light the path with red, blue, and orange colors. Next, Dee Simone explains how Sipe entertained his guests and shows me some of the estate's artifacts.
So we're on the first floor of the house, and as I mentioned earlier, it has four main rooms for entertaining. We're in the billiard room right now, music room. The dining room is directly behind us, and that's where you're hearing that music. It's a digital recording now, but it is of a Stella music box. This is real simple technology. It's a metal disc that's stamped, and you would crank it almost like a Victrola or an early record player, and metal tines are plucking it. This is, once again, in the time period, like record players don't exist. Edison's initial cylinder, which is that first recording of Mary Had a Little Lamb, is a few years off into the horizon. And that wouldn't have been, it would have been a novelty, not something you would play at a nice dinner. So they're very limited on sound because in a city like Milwaukee, Madison, Chicago, if you're having a fancy party, you could hire a string quartet. Way out here in the countryside, unless you have a family member that could play an instrument, chances are you would need something that's sort of pre-recorded. This is about one of your only options, like almost like a music box. Billiard room. The table's one of the oldest artifacts in the house. This table is from 1871. Conrad Seip purchased this after the Chicago fire for his home in Chicago initially, so he could entertain associates that had been displaced, either personally, like their homes were destroyed, or maybe their businesses. And then in 1888, when this house is built, it's moved up here. They're, of course, a brewing family. And what we're holding up here, these are little barrel napkin rings. And there was a full set. I believe there was as many as 34 of these. And over time, they, you know, were given to a family member or to a friend. And when Bill Peterson, that fourth generation owner, donated the house, he made sure that these two would stay here. These would have been probably either a housewarming gift or maybe a wedding gift to Conrad and Katerina. And so I think it speaks a little bit to Conrad and his family as well as his friends. You come to this really formal house or their home in Chicago, fancy dinner, there's silver napkin, and you pull it out and it's a beer barrel. Little tip of the cap to, like, he knows how he's made his good fortune. And then also, this is kind of fun. It's a Seip beer stein. And this is pre-prohibition, between 1900 and probably 1910 is what we date this. You're seeing Uncle Sam. And Uncle Sam is saying Seip's beer is A-OK. What's going on in this period, there's been a large push for 60, 70 years to outlaw alcohol through the temperance movement. There's also growing anti-German sentiment, especially in the early 19-teens as World War I is ratcheting up. American brewers at this time start to adopt American iconography in their advertising to showcase that they're a little bit more American. Seip picks Uncle Sam. Jacob Rupert, who is a New York brewer, has the Statue of Liberty, and Anheuser-Busch adopts the American Bald Eagle. You'll still see that on the Anheuser-Busch bottle. There's like an eagle, and he's holding arrows in one talon and quivers in the other. If you ever tour the Anheuser-Busch plant in St. Louis, right on the building in beautiful sculpture will be the American Bald Eagle. So it's a last-ditch attempt right before Prohibition hits that the brewers are saying, well, you could outlaw whiskey and all the hard spirits, but not, you know, beer is, it's a table beverage. It's we're patriotic, we're going to make it, but of course they don't. Like, they're all caught up. Wine, spirits, and beer are all outlawed. So those are kind of fun little, like I said, doffs of the cap or tips of the cap to Conrad understanding and knowing his good fortune. So what we really would like for people when they're leaving here, what we want them to take away is, yeah, the Seip story, it's interesting. The entrepreneurial story is definitely interesting and relevant in any period. You know, you have a good idea, you work hard, there's opportunities. Good luck is always involved in being successful. But that's, for many people, still the American dream. Like, if you have a great idea and you work hard and a couple things go your way, you could be successful in a line of business. But we also want people to leave here feeling maybe a little bit more excited and empowered about historic preservation, maybe hearing how difficult it was to save this place. And it took 10 years to go through some legal maneuvering. We're zoned residential. The museum's not residential. Would the community accept it? There was opposition. But this family stayed the course, and they wanted to make sure that it could be given to the state of Wisconsin for future generations. Maybe somebody's leaving here and going, you know, the old post office in town is slated for demolition. Or there is a house in my neighborhood that's going up for sale that's 120 years old, and I've always thought about buying an old home, but now I feel like I can do it. We want people when they leave here to just be a little bit more aware of the value of historic preservation and that it's not impossible.
Dave DeSimone is the director of Black Point Estate in Lake Geneva. He spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. Tavern Tuesdays is a partnership with Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin. The grand opening of Old World Wisconsin's Winton Abel's Tavern is May 17th. You can find more conversations from our Tavern Tuesday series at WUWM.com. When we come back, we'll share some spring and summer weather safety tips. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As the weather warms, flowers bloom and the birds return, winter is finally in the rearview mirror. But while dangerously cold temperatures and icy roads may be behind us, warm weather can bring its own set of emergencies, including tornadoes and flooding. Lake Effect Sam Woods is joined by Wisconsin Emergency Management's Public Information Officer Katie Rusnellos to talk about preparing for emergencies this spring and summer season.
So we're heading into the spring and summer months. Winter is over. But Katie, does that mean that we're out of the woods for emergency weather prep?
No, it doesn't. So there's a whole host of other weather things that can happen during the warmer months when you get into spring and summer. You get thunderstorms that can produce high winds. It can produce heavy rains that can cause flooding. There's lightning. And then there's also tornadoes. And the thing is, tornadoes can happen any time of year. And we saw that in 2024 in February, where that was the first February tornado in the state. But there has been a tornado recorded in Wisconsin in every single month of the year. So some of these things aren't just based on spring or summer. Sometimes they can happen in fall and winter as well.
So when thinking about extreme spring and summer weather here in Wisconsin, what are some things that you'd like us to keep in mind?
Some things to keep in mind with severe weather season is when there is flooding, whether that's river flooding or flash flooding, please do not drive your vehicle into flooded water. You don't know how deep it is. You don't know what's in it. The same goes for walking in the water. We've all seen those videos of people sloshing in the water, walking up and down the streets, or kids playing in it. The problem with that is you don't know what's in the water. There could be liquids that are contaminating the water. There could be dangerous items that you don't see because they're covered in water that you walk on. And with floodwaters, it only takes 6 inches to knock someone over. And that could potentially be a deadly situation that you would find yourself in. Other things to pay attention to would be tornadoes. If a tornado occurs, you'll hear an outdoor siren sometimes if your community has them. That's not 100% foolproof, because think about in those summer months when you have all your windows closed and the air conditioner is running, you're not going to hear that outdoor siren. So it's important to have multiple ways to receive emergency alerts. That could include having those emergency wireless emergency alerts on your phone turned on for emergency weather information. What happens with those is the National Weather Service will send then a little alert to your area where you are located at, and it will tell you, hey, there's a tornado warning. There's, you know, take shelter now. Other things would be having an NOAA weather radio, and those are good things to have because not only can you plug them in to an electrical outlet, they also can have batteries in there. So if there's a power outage, you can still get those alerts even though the power's not on because it is a battery-operated radio. And other ways to get those alerts are getting a weather app on your phone that can give those weather alerts to you, getting a phone call from family and friends saying, hey, I just saw that there's a tornado near your area, or even getting that information from your local TV or radio station.
Living in the Midwest has taught me one thing, is that the weather is constantly changing. And while we may be having tornadoes today, that it may very well be 95 degrees tomorrow. So thinking of summer heat emergencies, how do I know when I'm just feeling warm versus I am feeling so warm that I should seek medical attention?
So when you're feeling warm, that's one thing, as you were saying, but some things to look out for would be heat stroke, heat exhaustion, those issues. You might be having some heavy sweating. and you get cold, pale, clammy skin, fast, weak pulse. That's for heat exhaustion. For heat stroke, your body temperature is actually going to be rising up. So think like a fever. So if your temperature is 103 degrees or higher, that's very dangerous temperature to have. And if you have heat stroke, call 911 right away. It's very important to do that. And then if you are with someone who you think has heat stroke, you want to move that person to a cooler place and help lower the person's temperature with cool cloths or cool bath. Just don't give them anything to drink.
Katie Rusnellos is Wisconsin Emergency Management's Public Information Officer. She spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look ahead to the Black Birth Symposium, which convenes healthcare professionals and community advocates to advance collaborations and Black Birth outcomes. Plus, we'll help you plan a summer getaway to one of Wisconsin's most scenic destinations, the Apostle Islands. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.